Eat shit and die, Ricky!
Eat shit and live, Bill.
People's eyes are gonna pop out of their damn skulls when they see this.
Listen, you little bitch. You hang up on me again, I'll gut you like a fish.
Finger licking good.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast. I'm your host, Tim Trashmouth Mills, and today's guest is the one and only makeup effects artist, Christian Tinsley, of the upcoming Terrifier 3, the recently released Renfield. He did award-winning makeup for The Passion of the Christ. He also worked on the highly underrated Bug by the late legend William Friedkin and a ton more. But before we dive into all that, I just want to remind you guys that I'll be at Carolina Fear Fest on Memorial Day weekend. Walking around, just getting some interviews and just chatting with a few people. So if you see me out there, make sure you stop me and say what's up. You definitely hop on the mic and end up on the post coverage show. There's gonna be a ton of awesome guests and a bunch of awesome photo ops. Like, I know that the guy from the Myers House NC is bringing the car from It Follows. The car from Jeepers Creepers is gonna be there. The Green Goblin head from Maximum Overdrive. And then, of course, as far as guests, David Arquette, Heather Langenkamp, Amy Steele from Friday the 13th Part 2, Tom Matthews from Return of the Living Dead, as well as, you know, he's Tommy Jarvis in Part 6. So, ton of awesome guests. Make sure you come out and get your tickets if you haven't already at CarolinaFearFest.com. The link for that will be in the description. Also, just make sure you go follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and X for all updates on that, as well as the podcast. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so by sharing it around or rating and subscribing wherever you're listening. Or if you'd like to sign up for the Patreon, it is only $2 a month. The link for that is in the description. You'll get some stickers in the mail, a shout out on a future episode, and a couple other perks as well. So check that out if you're interested. With all that being said, thanks again for listening, and let's get into this week's episode.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. I see all the horror genre in the background there.
Hell yeah. Yeah, pretty much mostly cover horror stuff. And pretty much what I'll do is I'll ask like four or five questions about, you know, just your career and stuff like that and different things. And then on the back half, I'll probably just ask, you know, about your horror fandom, you know, if you're a horror fan. And then, of course, like what's some of your favorite horror movies, if so, and stuff like that. So
sure. Well, you got a few of them there.
Oh, yeah.
Ready. Yeah.
That's awesome. I was about to say, I figured you're a horror fan. You got some decapitated heads in your background. Usually you wouldn't keep those things around. If not.
Oh, yeah. There we go. We got Santa Clarita Diet up over here, and then American Gods over here.
Awesome. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Now we can dive right in if that's cool with you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. So pretty much my first question, you guys just wrapped up Terrifier 3. Of course, you know, no spoilers and everything like that. But I just wonder, if I'm not mistaken, you guys are the first, you know, makeup effects team to help Damien with one of these films. What was it like, you know, working with him and, you know, working with a director that usually does, you know, all of his own effects and stuff like that?
Yeah. You know, it's a great question because it was sort of my first experience doing that too. You know, what's funny is Damien has been sort of in connection and we've been sort of corresponding periodically over the last, I don't know, 7-8 years when he was first putting together the whole Art the Clown character, and he was first coming out with his first couple films. And I say first couple, I'm not talking about the second Terrifier, but the first Terrifier, Hallows Eve.
Yeah.
And he would sit there and go, hey, I'm doing this stuff. Check this out. If you get a chance, you know, to watch any of this. And I was always impressed because he was clearly an effects guy who wanted to make his horror movies and kind of do everything because probably I'm assuming a little bit due to circumstances of where he lived, sort of, you know, we all come from that place of creation. And when you're not, let's say, associated or affiliated with the industry already, you just sort of say, well, I'm going to make it all. I'm going to do everything.
Yeah.
I'm going to direct it. I'm going to write the story. I'm going to build the effects. And that's sort of what he did. The beautiful thing is, you know, Damien hit on the pulse of something that I think people were looking for and wanting, which was this sort of classic 80s slasher movie with this, you know, interesting and charismatic character that people could get drawn into. And it kind of hit a chord in it and it took off for him.
Yeah.
And it became something really special. And so because we were in correspondence over the years, I had reached out to him, you know, funny enough, about a year ago now, to talk to him about Art the Clown and some of the stuff, because I have a side company where we manufacture product for Halloween and other things. And I was actually contacting him to talk about licensing for some of his characters. And he wrote back and he goes, hey, you know, we're in the process of finishing up Terrifier 3, the script. He goes, would you by any chance be interested in doing the effects for it? And I was like, fuck yeah, that'd be awesome. Are you kidding me? And because I thought to myself at first too, when he asked the question, of, you know, my easy response is, yeah, of course. And I realized that my response was sort of automatic to just being in the industry, people saying, hey, I got this movie. I'm doing this Western. I got this film coming up. Would you be interested? It's like, yeah, of course. You know, give me a call. We'll have a meeting about it. Not even putting two and two together that it's like, well, wait, this is the Terrifier franchise. Damien's done all the effects himself. You know, kind of what am I getting into? But it was an exciting idea. And we continue to have some conversations about it via email, a couple of Zoom calls. And we just got jazzed about it. And I remember in the early on stages, I said, well, you know, obviously the first film is big. Second film gets bigger. What's the third film look like? And maybe I'll hold off to one of your other questions to talk about this. But he says, yeah, you know, it's about the size of the second one. And I go, okay, well, you don't have a script for me yet. So I'll just kind of take a look at the second one again, kind of write down some notes and be able to give you an idea. I said, you having done this by yourself, your cost differential from how I would do it is going to be drastic. So let's just start working on that idea from the beginning so you don't have any surprises and maybe you're not jumping into something that you don't want to financially get involved with. And he was like, yeah, that's great. That's great. So that's how we kind of started the conversation.
Hell yeah. No. And that's one thing is when you get a call, you know, for that franchise, it's kind of, I could see where it'd be exciting for a lot of, you know, makeup effects teams. Cause it's, you know, that they're going to be going for, you know, practical effects, you know, the whole way. And then, you know, that they're going to be shooting, you know, to the top of the second movie, which has got one of the craziest scenes ever with, you know, the animatronic girl that's pretty much still alive. And Allie, I think is the character's name. That's one of the craziest things to me is the way that she's like still moving where she's been filleted and stuff. I love that. So I'm excited to see what you guys do with 3 for sure.
Oh, it's well, I guess to kind of continue where I left off. Yeah. He said, we're doing this, you know, just look at the second one. I was like, okay. I looked at the second one. I started putting some numbers together. It's like, okay, well, that's a fake head. You got the Art the Clown makeup. You got, you know, I just started dissecting it. And I sort of put together my own list. And then I think it was a short couple weeks later, Damien sent me an effects breakdown. He still hadn't sent me the script. He was still working on it. And he goes, here's a list of a bunch of effects that are in part 3. I was like, okay, well, this would be great. You know, here's a guy who knows what he's doing, knows what he wants. He's writing the script. This is going to be sort of this definitive list I can look at, whereas most directors have no idea really what's in their film.
Yeah.
They come to us and say, what do you think I need as far as an effect goes? And I was like, this is going to be great. I got Damien's list and I started going through it. I was like, holy shit. I was like, I called up Damien right away and I go, Damien, I got your list. And he goes, yeah, what do you think? I go, you said this was the size of part 2. And he goes, yeah. And I go, this isn't even fucking close to the size of part 2. Yeah. I was like, this is quite literally 3 times the size of part 2. I was like, you got this kill, you got this kill, you got this kill, you got this kill. And he was like, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess it is a little bit bigger. And I go, it's not even a little bit bigger, man. This thing is massive. And I go, I haven't even read the script. And he goes, well, by the way, I'm going to send you the script this weekend. Great. He sends me the script. I start reading the script to put everything into context now, right? Like where it's at. As I'm reading the script, I call him back and I say, hey, I just finished up your script. And he goes, yeah. And I go, not only is your list of effects 3 times bigger than the second movie, I said, but you didn't even include half of this stuff. I said, there's stuff you didn't even put on your list. And he goes, oh yeah, I forgot to put that stuff on there. I go, dude, this thing is gigantic. And he goes, yeah, but this kill and this kill, these are my main kills. And as we continue the conversation, I go, how would I know that those are your main kills? And he goes, well, what do you mean? And I go, what makes that a bigger kill than this kill? I said, you have 8 major kills in this. Why are these 2 your major ones? And he goes, oh yeah. Yeah, I guess they're all big major kills. And I go, dude, this is massive. So it ended up being one of these projects that grew beyond the initial conversation and into something so massive that, look, the Terrifier fans, if they love the first one and the second one for the gore, for the practical effects, for the constant sort of providing of that element in a film, this is essentially going to be 2.5 hours of non-stop gore. It's just, oh, yeah. It doesn't end. It does not end.
Yeah, I figured that's probably what he was thinking when he was like, oh, it's the same size as the other movie. It's probably like the same runtime, but like the gore can be upped, you know, 3 times in that same runtime. So, no, oh. That's wild. And even the second one, though, people forget like how much actual gore is in it because, you know, they always think about like certain kills, you know, like the alley death and stuff. But it's like from Jump Street, he's ripping the eye out of the guy and, you know, putting it in his face. And then he's like shitting himself in the laundry room. So it's like, those are all effects, you know, like even the shit, you know, that comes out, you know, when he was shitting in the laundry room, you know, that's an effect. So it's like, no, it's, I can see what you mean. It's definitely where it's, if it's triple that, I'm excited for it. I didn't get to catch 2 in theaters, but I really liked 2. I really liked 1 too, you know, 1 a lot as well. But I prefer 2 a little bit more just because, you know, you get a true final girl and stuff like that and a good protagonist to the antagonist. But I'm really excited to see 3. I'll definitely be in theaters for that. Might even sign petition that's going around for a popcorn bucket for it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, is there a petition going around for that?
Yeah, there's a I joined the Art the Clown Appreciation Society or whatever on Facebook just to kind of, you know, keep up with like events and stuff that they might do in the area and whatnot. And, you know, any other news, because they're quick to post. They were like the first ones to post when you guys, you know, finished filming and stuff. So I joined that and they have been posting in there. There's a change.org position to get a popcorn bucket for when the film drops, because, of course, it'll get a theatrical release after, you know, the success of 2. But
oh, yeah, look, it's going to be huge. It's going to be huge. I keep telling people that they're like, you know, because there's a lot of people, especially in the film industry. And we just went through a big strike. So people have been asking, what have you been working on? What have you been doing? I was like, I was doing the Terrifier movie. And you say Terrifier 3, and a lot of people go, oh, you're working on a third part of a franchise. That doesn't really mean anything. Oh, I've never heard of that movie, right? And I'm like, oh, I said, we're doing Terrifier 3. It's going to be fucking huge. And they go, really? It's the third one? I haven't even heard of the first two. And I go, it doesn't matter. I was like, the 3 is going to be, I say, come October, all anybody's going to talk about is Terrifier 3 at the movie theaters. That's it. It's going to take over the movie theaters in October.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm excited to be in a theater full of people that, you know, just aren't used to seeing that type of stuff and whatnot. Cause that's another thing is people will just kind of wander in, you know what I mean? Without really watching the first few, or, you know, they watch them, but they were hard to get through those ones. So they come and struggle through the third one still, cause they just love them. So,
For
sure. But hell yeah. And, of course, you know, we mentioned how Art the Clown is, you know, become iconic. You've worked on a ton of iconic, you know, characters and just people, you know, from Jonah Hex, you know, with comic books to Jesus Christ himself, you know, and Passion of the Christ, award-winning makeup. And then to, the Lord and Savior, to us here at Horrorflix and Guitar Picks, Nicolas Cage as Dracula. How has it worked? Renfield is one of my favorite horror comedies of the last decade. What was it like, you know, taking on, you know, an iconic character like Dracula? And then, you know, of course, that was another, you know, blood-filled, you know, hyper-gory, fun film. What was it like, you know, taking that on with, you know, action instead of, you know, like horror?
You know, it was good. It was again, in one of those situations where I got a call, Universal, we're going to be doing the new Dracula movie. And I was like, oh, that's great. And I was flattered that I got the call to do it, and or at least being considered for it. And at the time, it was going to be Jude Law playing Dracula.
Oh, shit.
That was, so I was really, too. You know, so yeah, they put Jude Law, you know, Dracula movie, Universal Studio Monsters, and they kind of pitched me this and they said, great, we're going to send you over the script. And I was like, wonderful. And I was really jazzed about it. And I started reading the script and I was picturing Jude Law being the character as Dracula, and Nicholas Holt, they had planned on being Renfield at the time. And I was kind of putting the images in my head as I was reading it. And I got through the script and I realized, I was like, this is a comedy. That's not what I expected. Like, what is happening here? I went into it with this mentality of we're doing like the new Universal Monsters Dracula movie, which I think is what Universal had in mind, but they were trying to do something maybe more DC versus Marvel they were doing. This is the version, not the Mummy with Tom Cruise kind of feel. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is, I got to get into a different mindset because this is drastically different than what I was expecting.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got on a phone call with Chris McKay, who I immediately fell in love with, as a human being. He's wonderful. Great to talk to, very collaborative. Loved everything about Chris McKay. I felt like, you know, from the beginning, they switched positions from Jude Law to Nicolas Cage, which at first, and I'm a huge Nick Cage fan, but I was a little bit worried. I was like, oh, this is taking one more step towards this.
The camp is the
arena that I wasn't expecting, but now it could be more fun. And like, you know, with the comedy sensibility and, but with Nick Cage, this could be getting cool now. I don't know. We'll see. And then we started designing, I thought, some really neat stuff for it and had a lot of freedom. And then I think as we were filming it, we all felt really good about where it was going. But, you know, ultimately in the end, it was an absolute fun popcorn movie. It was absolutely fun. And if you watch it with eyes a second or a third time, understanding that, it's actually a really great movie.
Yeah.
It could have been, I think, a lot better if they would have allowed Chris to come back and do some reshoots that it clearly needed. But the studio kind of, you know, by the time it was done, the studio just sort of, I think, shut it down, didn't want to spend another penny because there was clearly some moments in there where it felt like, and we all knew it deserved a little adjustment, probably a few extra days of filming just to tighten a few things up, maybe move a couple story plots and you know, around. And they just, I don't think they gave it to them. And they kind of said, look, you got to release it for what it is.
Yeah.
And it was still fun as hell. And look, Nick Cage was fantastic. I mean, if you don't love every scene that Nick Cage is in, then you're watching the wrong kind of movie.
Right. And then, of course, you know, you get to play in the world of, you know, those scenes where, you know, they put him on Bela Lugosi. And then one thing that's super cool about it is that it's like, in a way, it's attached to every single other, you know, well, not every single, but like a bunch of different, you know, variants of the Dracula film. You know, he's a Coppola, so it's a, you know, attached to that in a way. It's, you know, Bela Lugosi. Then, of course, the way the scene plays out, you know, when you're first introduced to, you know, Dracula when he's weak, you know, that was a sequel to, I think, Blood for Dracula, if I'm not mistaken, or I can't remember exactly the name, but it was like a sequel to another one. So it was just, you know, there's so many different Dracula films that it's attached to that also is super awesome. And then with, you know, Voyage of the Demeter and then Nosferatu coming up, it was nice that it ended up playing into that comedy because it sets itself apart from all those other vampire movies that are going to do the dark, you know,
oh, sure,
horror stuff. And one thing I like about it is that it played the horror comedy aspect up, but it still kept Dracula a bad guy and a villain. And made Renfield the funny, you know, nice guy. So it was kind of cool.
Yeah. The whole movie revolved around this centerpiece of Dracula that was, in an essence, sort of real. He wasn't playing comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick Cage is a smart guy. He knew there was comedic value to what he was doing, but he was playing it really grounded. He wanted to be Dracula.
Yeah.
And all the stories around him sort of went off on this twirly sort of fantasy, and it let it be that. We did do all the effects in that film practical. They enhanced quite a few moments with digital blood,
yeah.
Which I know in the end, a lot of people said, oh, the movie's just covered in digital blood. And it's like, it's not. There are key moments that they did it. And it was kind of unfortunate because Nick Holt punching that guy's head off, you know, and the fountain of blood coming out, that was all real. Then they sort of superimposed even more digital blood,
yeah.
Which, in my opinion, didn't need, but I knew what Chris was trying to do in post-production. In post-production, he realized the kind of movie he had. And he said, look, I got to go head first into this genre of comedy. And by doing that, I need to have even more almost fantasy-like elements that sort of surround it. And so he ended up adding it a lot in spaces to sort of make it so over the top and bubbly that it wasn't like a Terrifier blood where everything is really grounded and visceral. This was, we're going to kind of almost make you laugh at the amount that it is.
Yeah, almost like Tarantino blood, where it's like, even though he's playing it straight in Tarantino films, the blood when he's, you know, when she's chopping off arms and Kill Bill against yes. the crazy 88s is just like, and of course that's the same people that did Evil Dead, you know, can be. So of course it's the same yeah. Evil Dead 2 blood. So I guess I could have went with Evil Dead 2, but it's just that bright red, like, you know, over the topness. That's one thing, you know, I listen to the Movie Crypt a lot with like Adam Green and Joe Lynch, and they always bring up how they used to give them such crap about like, oh, they chop the head too many times in the scene. And it's like, yeah, but if you stop the chops, it becomes too brutal. You know what I mean? Like the amount of chops makes it a joke. You know what I mean? So it's like,
right.
It's one of those things. I'm with you. It's like by throwing that CGI blood on it, you're not really, you know, making it less brutal looking or anything like that. All you're doing is, like you said, kind of giving those people a reason to complain. Oh, there's just CGI blood. But no, that's one thing is that there's so much blood in that movie that the few times, like you said, they do enhance it. It's not enough to like take me out of it. Like some people, like not to knock anybody else's work. And if you ended up, I don't think you worked on it, but if you worked on Malignant, I'm sorry, but
no, but
Malignant is one of those films I feel like just did it too much. You know what I mean? Like every bit of blood was covered with CGI blood, and it like almost took me out of the film. I still enjoyed it, but not like Renfield, where it was like, oh, I could see why, you know, they might've done it here or there, but you know, color correction not working or whatever. But it definitely yeah. wasn't like, you know, like I said, in Malignant, where it was almost every scene with blood was like, felt like it was, it almost felt like they didn't have practical to like rely on, you know, like they did it with intention to put CGI blood.
Right.
No, and then of course, like, you know, I mentioned that those were iconic characters, but you've also worked with iconic directors with one of my favorite and most underrated films. I feel like in Bug, you worked with William Friedkin, the two great actors and actress as well, with Ashley Judd and Michael Shannon. What was it like, you know, working with Friedkin? And then of course, doing a film like that where characters change over time throughout the film, did you guys get to film that in order, or was that something that was really difficult trying to keep up with, you know, where they're out, you know, at in their story this day and, you know, the next day and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, look, continuity is always an issue in film. And so it's always great when you can build into a character and continue going. Bug was a small enough film because it primarily is two people in a hotel room, you know, going crazy and on these drug trips, that most of it was shot in order. That was also, I had worked with Michael Shannon a few times, and Michael's friend wrote the screenplay for theater, and Michael played the main character in the stage play.
Yeah.
And so then when it was adapted to the film and William Friedkin got attached to it, Michael Shannon wrote me and said, hey, look, you've been doing all my like makeup effects for the stage play. He was buying and ordering from me for his stage play performance. He goes, we're going to make the film. I want you to do my makeup as well. I was like, great. That's how I got brought into that. We were shooting primarily in continuity. Ashley had a couple effects on her, but she had her own makeup artist dealing with her look. We of course had the brutal stabbing at the end where Michael Shannon kills his psychologist.
Yeah.
That was a trippy movie. You know, I was excited to work with Billy because he is such an iconic director, like you said, and from, you know, everything going back to The Exorcist and French Connection and stuff. But we'd all heard the horror stories about how he is on set. And, you know, at this point in his career, he was, I think, a little bit more tame and relaxed. He had some funny quirks about him. He used to like to call everybody Mo on set. And I think it really had something to do with probably he just didn't want to memorize everybody anymore. You know, too many people on a set. And he's just like, yeah, Mo, everybody was Mo from the Three Stooges, of course.
Yeah.
One of the sets caught on fire when towards the end, when the flames are going in the building and they have the whole room covered with tin foil. We were shooting on a high school gymnasium. That's where that set was built during the summer down in New Orleans. It was a small film, low budget, and the set caught on fire one day. The flames just sort of engulfed the whole room from behind the camera crew when it wasn't supposed to.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was kind of this crazy little independent filmmaking process, but man, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Michael's great, but he is, you know, he's definitely a bit of a method actor. And so, you know, that was a hard character to play, being a method actor. You know, not that he did any drugs to become that character, but He was very intense and very focused. And sometimes that makes it for an uncomfortable moment when you have to spend an hour or two putting on makeup, because it's not filled with a lot of, you know, hey, how was dinner last night? What'd you go do? You're going to have something fun this weekend to do? I mean, you just, it wasn't about any of that. It was about getting the job, getting out there, doing it.
Oh, yeah. No, Michael Shannon's probably top three actors for me, maybe with like Christopher Lloyd, because Back to the Future is my favorite film, and maybe Nicolas Cage just because of like the way he goes for whatever the fuck he needs to go for, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I love Michael Shannon. I even thought about going and catching him right now. He's on tour just doing REM covers. I was like, damn, I might just go catch that. So,
seriously?
Yeah, he's coming through here. It's him and a bunch of his buddies. He's doing vocals, and he's got a band backing him up, and they're doing, I guess it's like his old band from, you know, back in the day, and they're doing REM covers and stuff. So I've always said if they remake Phantasm, he needs to play the tall man. So he'd be perfect.
Oh, he'd be perfect.
But especially after seeing him play Zod, you know, so, but yeah, you know, I think, but that's one of the reasons, you know, Friedkin's great, of course, but Michael Shannon's performance in that and Judd's are just, you know, next level. And that's one thing that carries that film is they pick the right two people to just, you know, have two people carry a film. That's for sure. But
yeah.
But no, but you know, like that film has a couple crazy effects, you know, where he's like cutting into his own arm and they're freaking out about, you know, all the stuff. What's maybe one of the wildest things, you know, and it doesn't have to even be a horror movie, you know, it could just be some like, you know, off the wall, you know, comedy or even, you know, action film or something. What's one of the craziest things you've done to like achieve an effect, you know, or like a craziest ingredient you would say or something like that?
Wow. That's a big question. You know, I got to go through 25 years of memories here to try to figure that one out. What is one of the craziest effects? I don't know, man. They've, you know, every makeup effect comes with its, you know, its challenges. And, you know, I've been blessed to personally, you know, do quite a few, as well as I have a great team, you know, that, you know, everybody's mind works differently. So some of the crazy shit that people come up with to achieve something, is it's, you know, it's a blessing to kind of see that process happen. You know, speaking of Terrifier 3, Damien has certainly challenged us with doing a lot of effects in there that I normally probably lean more on production to do a marriage with visual effects, right? Because, you know, there are things that work better when you marry the two. Like, we'll take it to this point, you continue it from this point forward, and then it'll look seamless to the audience. He, you know, like you said, everything is in camera. It's real.
Yeah.
There's very few moments where digital is going to step in and do a little cleanup or a little pre-cleanup to help reveal something. It's all pretty practical. So I can't really talk about the effects that we did for it, but there were certainly a couple in there that were, you know, probably could answer the question that you've asked. You know, we did some stuff for Babysitter Part 2, Mick G's sequel, where a guy gets chopped. He gets drawn under a boat and the propeller starts chopping up his head and his leg. And he wanted to do all that practical. So we had to figure out how to build a head that could be chopped up and then reset and chopped up again for take after take. So we could, you know, until they get the right take they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, those are fun things. We've done, you know, melting heads in the past, back when I worked at Steve Johnson's, where we would use like paper pulp combined with sort of, you know, ingredients to hold it together in the mold. And then when you pumped fluids from behind, it wouldn't just melt like wax under a heat gun, but it would sort of like fall apart and crumple.
Yeah.
We did stuff like that. You know, oh no, I don't know, man. There's always something crazy, right? You're always, and here's the problem with what we do is we all try to consider ourselves like mad little genius scientists in some way. And I think sometimes to our detriment, we look at something that we've done 100 times and we go, how can we do it different? How can we do it different? And so we're always sort of like putting these walls that we're trying to break down that are somewhat unnecessary. Sometimes it's done well, just do it like that again.
Yeah.
But man, I wish I could give you a good example of like, there was this one effect kind of thing, but I don't know if there is. They're all so different for different reasons, you know? Can you think of one that I've done that maybe you could spark something in me to remember? I don't know.
Well, when what was it? You know, when you're doing something like, for instance, you know, Renfield, where he throws the arm through the guy, like what's the something like that? Like, how do you achieve something where it's like you get make sure the arm like goes to the, you know, is that all was that helped with CGI at all? You know, or was that something that was like, you know, a string pulley or?
It's a combination. So we had like a chess piece with the arm that was stuck into it. And so they would do all the action leading up to him hitting. We'd place the arm on this sort of mechanism to look like it was sticking out of his chest. They would continue filming. And then, yeah, visual effects would marry sort of this blur coming into hitting him. It's like the typical, you know, arrow in the head, you know, the camera pans and whips to it concept. Now the arms being ripped off, prior to that, when he rips the guy's arms off and then starts swinging around, that was all practical. We built the shoulder rigs with these lightweight arms that Nicholas Holt would hold on to. And we had chambers built into the arms that ran from the hands up through Nicholas Holt's sleeve and then back out the other side. And then on the actors whose arms get ripped off, we also had tubes coming up going to the shoulders. And the reason for that is as soon as you rip them off, rather than have blood coming just from the shoulders out, we had blood coming from the arms in, so it would sort of explode.
Yeah.
So the water would hit each other or the blood would hit each other and then sort of explode outwards. And so we built these custom tanks inside the fake arms that were filled with blood that had this air supply on a trigger, like I said, that ran through Nicholas Holt's arms up his sleeves. And so on the count of three, when he kicks the guy and the arms pull off, both cannons explode. And, you know, I mean, you know, fun stuff like that where you're sitting there going, okay, we're going to rip a couple guys' arms off. And then the director comes back and says, yeah, but I want 2 gallons of blood to shoot out. And he's like, okay, well now fuck, how are we going to do that? And you keep sort of going in reverse, solving a problem, you know, building two more questions, solving those, you know, coming up with answers. And then, you know, that builds another three questions and you just keep going until you got everything hopefully solved.
Oh yeah. And then, like you said, it's like when you want to top everything, you know, like not top everything, but you know, you want to be original. So you want to do something different. So you wanted to shoot out of both things. Then you got to figure out timing and all that. So no, I definitely understand that. But hell yeah. And then even kind of to throw one out that's non-horror, but I feel like that's one thing I always like is horror things and non-horror places. And your award-winning makeup and, of course, Passion of the Christ. There's a scene in that where he's like dragging the cross through and there's like a demon face. Of course, that's not like a hard effect, I'm sure, and stuff like that. But what was it like, you know, coming up with something like that, you know, trying to, you know, just portray a demon like within the film that's, you know, playing into like, you know, religion in a real way, not, you know, it's not playing into it as like this is an exorcism film, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I got to be honest with you, I had nothing to do with that. That was a post-production decision that they had made and that they had comped in later. And my only focus on that film, which was obviously the primary focus of it, was Jim Caviezel's makeup as Jesus. So thankfully, I was sort of tunneled visioned on that film just to worry about him. And we had this amazing Italian crew that dealt with every other character in that project and did obviously such a seamless job with every other character that the whole thing blended well. And you never got yourself. I don't ever felt like you were able as an audience to feel like you were taken out of the film because something looked incorrect or wrong.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, for your question, that had nothing to do with me. It was a very cool moment. I was living in just, you know, cuts and wounds and blood and fake noses and beards and everything that whole, that whole time.
Oh no, those effects are freaking phenomenal. Obviously you want an award for them and stuff. When I saw that movie quite a few times just because, you know, I live in North Carolina. I'm not religious myself, but you know, I have religious family. So there's a couple times where I was dragged to the theater and I was like, this is a great movie. So
it's
like
a great movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And
you don't have to be religious to appreciate that movie as far as the film. It's right up there with one of the better films. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just, but that scene always stuck out to me is like, I was young, kind of young seeing it, like maybe like 11, 12. And I was just getting into horror. I was like, that fucking scared me. Like that guy's face. So that's why I was figured I'd ask. But yeah. But, you know, of course, you know, if I would have tried to see Terrifier at 11 or 12, they would have been like, hell no. But they'll like, they'll let me go watch Jesus get beat to death because it's religious.
Because it's religious, right? It's, yeah. It's justified. This, yeah, I know. And you could always justify, well, this really happened because it was Jesus. It's like, well, people really get killed too. But
yeah, I'm sure there's some war movies they wouldn't let me watch in the 90s, you know what I mean? Or early 2000s for sure. But
oh, yeah.
But hell yeah. And then just before I dive into just asking you about like some of your favorite horror movies, and then, you know, I do have a question that I end with all my guests that I like to ask if they have a horror story of their own. So if you want to kind of like think about that in the back of your mind, you know, whether it's on, you know, a day on set or just in your personal life. But before I dive into, you know, those few questions, do you have anything you want to promote, you know, whether it's out now or, you know, coming up that you've worked on that you're really excited about?
Well, yeah, I mean, Terrifier 3 is the one that we're all looking forward to that comes out in October. I'm sure your guests already know it's October 25th, which we're excited about.
Oh, yeah.
We're currently finishing up the Michael Jackson film. We got Chief of War, a new Jason Momoa episodic coming out on Apple next year. That's taken, you know, took up 10 months of our lives last year to make and create. Which is very cool, but it's less of a horror thing. It's about the late 1700s Hawaiian islands and the battles that were taking place between the tribes and stuff. So some pretty cool stuff there. Yeah, no, I mean, constantly working on some, one of the things that I'm most excited about, and to kind of go back to how we even got attached with Terrifier, is Tinsley Transfers is a company that I have where we make Halloween products. And one of the things that we've gotten really into is licensing this last year or two. And I see a bunch of, you know, images on your walls. And one of the big things that we took over was the Universal licensing. So we're going to be doing Art the Clown masks. We have lined up some other characters from Terrifier that are coming out in Terrifier 3 that we're going to be doing, which is very exciting. We're doing the new version of the 1970s Michael Myers mask, which were, you know, look, anything we do, I'm trying to be authentic to the consumer and to the world in which it was built. So I feel like we're going to have, you know, the closest thing to the original Mike Myers version of the, you know, Captain Kirk mask out there. We're doing the Chucky. We're doing a fantastic Chucky mask. That's amazing. We got some American Werewolf in London masks coming out. So I know these aren't horror movies, but they're horror elements. And I just think, you know, between myself and some of the artists that, that I have working with me in our studio for the film stuff, who's helped build these elements, we just got some cool shit coming out. That's going to be really neat for the collectors and, or the fans.
Oh yeah. No, no, definitely. Put that, you know, link to the website in the description for anybody that wants to check out, you know, what you guys got, you know, sign up for a newsletter if there's any way to do that and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that'd be great. Yeah. We're going to probably start doing early releases and pre-orders on that kind of stuff, come June, July. So
hell yeah.
Probably a little premature right now to send them there, but, it'll be cool.
Oh yeah. Which this will come out mid May or whatever. So it might be a little, more going by then, but at least they'll know where to look, you know, when the time comes, if they don't already, you know, follow it and stuff like that, which I'm sure they do, but no, hell yeah, I'm excited for that stuff as well. And Universal, I love all, you know, I love that they have, you know, people, as soon as they think of Universal, they think of the classic stuff, but I'm glad that, you know, other stuff is attached to Universal, you know, more recent monsters. My favorite is Creature from the Black Lagoon, you know, from the Universal stuff. So,
Yeah, we were starting on that one right now.
Hell yeah. No, I'm excited to see what you guys do with that for sure. I might be ordering one of those myself. I have the three. Halloween 3 masks are just covered up by other stuff right now because my son plays with a Chucky, so that Chucky moves all the time. So.
That one moves all the time. All right.
Yeah. But he's into horror because of Creature from the Black Lagoon. It was my backdrop, and he has to watch it one day, and ever since then, he's 3 years old watching horror movies and stuff. So.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But hell yeah. But it's, you know, to kind of, I'll use that as my segue, you know, what was your relationship with horror movies growing up? And, you know, like, are you a fan of them? And obviously you're a fan of, you know, cinema in general, you know, being, you know, they work in the business and stuff, but would you say that horror films are one of your like top genres, or, you know, just one that you tend to watch, you know, from time to time?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. I mean, look, it's, I mean, horror movies is what got me started into this business, right? And I don't think it had to necessarily do with the fact that it was horror movies. I just think that's what was showcasing the type of thing that I wanted to do the most.
Yeah.
I think we were all fans of the original Star Wars movies, at least my generation. You're a little bit younger than I am. So, you know, I grew up with Star Wars, and I grew up with those 70s movies that weren't necessarily horror, but I was definitely in my prime when things like American Werewolf in London came out, The Thing.
Yeah.
You know, Back to the Futures are some of my favorite movies. I think you even said it's one of your favorites.
My favorite of all time. Yep, Back to the Future.
I watch those at least once a year still, you know. I mean, all these movies were so Altered States, that Dick Smith did. I was just a fan of movies that showcased this type of work. I think in the 80s, when there were horror movies being delivered every other week, and most of them not good, they were just, you know, slasher porn to be slasher porn. You know, even the Friday 13th movies and things like that were less about makeup effects, and they were really trying to be, you know, these sort of scary pop scare movies. Whereas Nightmare on Elm Street had this great character covered in makeup effects, Freddy and stuff like that. But I would say, I don't live in a world of horror movies. I'm also, 50 years old, and I got kids, and, you know, so if you came to my house, I'm not covered in sort of like gothic black walls or anything like that, but I certainly can appreciate a good horror movie. My favorites and the ones that I've shown my kids, throughout the years. I mean, you have a few of them right on your wall. I was going to say Evil Dead 2, probably one of my favorites, kind of changed my perspective on horror movies, how they can be made, what you can do with them, how fun they can be. You know, even looking back on American Werewolf in London, that was when I was a kid, it wasn't a comedy.
Yeah.
But as an adult, it's a comedy. And it's kind of crazy how your perspective changes. I was going to say Sleepaway Camp, probably one of the most terrifying moments in a movie is that very last 3 seconds as the credits going to roll. Just horrifying. And to this day, still freaks me out.
Yeah, she goes from being this gentle girl filmed to being like feral as hell and like screaming, and she just decapitated somebody. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah. And just the weirdest image to leave you with, that static still image. And the fact that that was a mask that they made kind of blew my mind. A movie like The Changeling, George C. Scott 70s, Changeling, still one of the most terrifying movies for me to watch. And it's all psychological horror. It's not monsters. It's not blood. It's not gore. It's just this ghost story movie that's done so well, in my opinion, that it's freaky. The sounds are what's terrifying to me. The kid in the tub hitting the side of it, and the camera roaming down the halls, and the little ball falling down the stairs. Like, all that shit is just frightening.
Yeah, I was just about to say, when he takes the ball and drives it like miles away and then comes back and literally it falls immediately down the steps, my heart stopped the first time I saw it. That's probably my favorite 80s supernatural horror movie. There might be one that, well, I don't know. I guess if you count, like you said, Nightmare on Elm Street is kind of supernatural slasher, but as far as like Haunted House, Changeling is definitely top three, top five for me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they did another one. I think it was in the late 90s. I want to say Guillermo was a producer on it. It was called The Orphanage.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
That was the first movie I had seen since The Changeling that I thought, wow, this is a terrifying movie. Like, this is scary. Not bloody, not pop scary, but it's sort of like leaves you with this sinking feeling of horror. What's another good one? I thought Hereditary for more recent horror movies was fantastic. What was another? There's another one that just popped into my head that I forgot. It was after The Orphanage, but before Hereditary. I can't think of it off the top of my head right now. But yeah, I mean, look, there's great things being done out there still.
Yeah. But another one around that time that wasn't really scary, but I just thought it had a good twist on it. And overall, it had like a good gothic look was The Others with Nicole Kidman. I like that one a lot as well. So it's probably not in my top five or anything, but it's definitely one I feel like people forget about because it wasn't super scary. And, you know, it was more like just creepy and eerie. It was very, felt like The Innocence, you know, the old school, The Innocence from back in the 70s and stuff. So, of course, you got The Haunting, the original film, you know, all those are great too, as far as like haunted house films. But no, I agree. Those, some of those movies just fall by the wayside as far as like haunted house films in general. I feel like people just like, you have ones every now and then that like leave a mark, like The Changeling, then, you know, just shoot forward. You have like Others and the other ones we mentioned, but then you have like It Took a While, and then like The Conjuring finally like rejuvenated it, you know, when that came around and stuff like that. So that's a genre that I feel like comes and goes, kind of like slasher films, you know, like they have these films that really kick off a new genre, like a new wave of them every couple years or every decade at least. So
yeah. And you know, some of these, like the original Saw, right? Fantastic premise, great concept, horrifying when you think about, you know, the realities of like, hey, you have a choice to be, you know, made here, and one's not a good choice and the other one's a worse choice. those are great concepts. That, you know, the hard thing that I have with any of these types of movies nowadays, less than what they did back in the 80s, is that everything has to be now a franchise, right? Everything has to be, can we build a part 9 into this? And it's like, Jesus Christ, it's just, it starts to just water it down, numb it. And then it becomes, like I said, it just becomes like horror porn at that point, as opposed to with this great underlying premise. I just heard Blumhouse speak. That was probably 9 months ago. I was at this, this place where he was speaking. And one of the great things he said, true or not, isn't my place to say, but he said, you know, anytime we make a film, I always tell the directors, which are usually first time directors, he goes, I always tell them, don't ever tell me that you have a second movie in mind, or we're going to end this movie with this idea that we can make a sequel. He goes, make a great movie. We can always figure out how to make a sequel.
Yeah.
But make a great movie that's all by itself, that doesn't need a sequel, and put all your energy into that. And if it does really well, yeah, we can milk this cow for the years to come.
Yeah.
If you don't make a first good movie, then it doesn't matter if you have a second idea in mind or a third idea. If it fails, it's not good.
Yeah.
And you're never going to see the second one. And I thought that was a really nice perspective to see somebody like that have, because all of a sudden it was like, yeah, stop worrying about how you can rewrite a character back into it. You can always come up with an idea for that. That's, everybody will give you grace if the movie was so good and they want to see those characters come back.
Yeah. No, and except for like Ty West doing the, you know, Pearl X trilogy and stuff like that right now, most of my favorite directors are doing nonstop original films, you know, Jordan Peele. And of course I love, you know, the Terrifier franchise, but like Jordan Peele, Robert Eggers, my son's name is Ari, so that'll tell you how much I love, and he's 3 years old, so that'll tell you how much I love Hereditary and Midsommar and all that. So it's Hereditary is one of those films I tell people it's in my top three. I know I keep saying top three, top five, but it's different stuff, but Hereditary is in my top three, just in of all time. My top three is Scream, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Hereditary. And it's because after a couple of years, you know, the recency bias can only, you know, hang around for so long. It's just, I'm with you. That film is so great and stuff like that. But when people like prepare these films for sequels, and you can see it with Blumhouse, like even look at The Purge, the first Purge film, it left no room for a sequel. They fucking killed everybody. Everybody was dead except for the mom and the kids. And then at that point, I mean, it was almost like the only thing really that they could have done is what they ended up doing eventually with the TV series, where it shows like in between the Purge, you know, because what, like within a year, I'm sure all that awkwardness is gone, or, you know, people move away and, you know, you can't do anything for a whole year. So, so like, if you look at a lot of these Blumhouse properties, they almost do play, like even Happy Death Day, that was Blumhouse. And it was so successful that they made a second one work, but the first one ends without, you know, like that cliffhanger. So I definitely can see where they come up with that. And some of their films, of course, might leave a little bit of a, you know, a hint of a sequel, but definitely nothing. And even some of their sequels, like one of their best sequels is Ouija 2, Origin of Evil. It like is way better than the first movie. And that's because it's like a prequel and it doesn't really need to rely on the original. It just kind of goes in and plays on the Ouija part, you know, so.
But, yeah.
Hell yeah, that's definitely a good way to for them to look at it. I feel like A24 does the same thing, but that's I feel like Blumhouse and A24 are the two that really get credit for leaving their directors alone as well. Blumhouse, I feel like sometimes might. Oh hell yeah, that's awesome.
A24. There you go, buddy. Yeah, no, they're the best.
Yeah, and I feel like Blumhouse might sometimes be like, hey, we would really like a PG-13 horror movie. But other than that, them and A24 definitely leave their directors alone more than, like Universal or Warner Brothers and stuff like that. So,
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
but hell yeah. Any other horror movies you want to shout out before I ask the final question about Horror Story?
Horror movies to shout out. I know my list is long of ones that I always feel like people should have in their back pocket, right? Like
Yep.
here are the 10 movies you had to have seen, right? You gotta have them. Anytime I run into, and it's funny, I have some of this younger generation I'll hire, they'll come into the studio, they'll be working on a project with us. We'll start talking about films. And I'd be like, well, have you ever, you've seen this movie, right? And they'll be like, no. I was like, how are you even working in this industry and not seeing this movie?
Yeah.
And we'll start going through the list. And it's amazing at how many classic, and when I say classic, my classics are different than Rick Baker's classics. And they're certainly different than the new generation's classics, but there are some that are, I feel like, are just evergreens, right? Like you had to have seen the original Hunchback of Notre Dame. Like you just have to. Like
Yeah.
if you're going to be in makeup, you got to have seen that movie. You have to have seen American Werewolf in London and The Thing, right? Those are just ones you had to have seen. If you didn't see Total Recall, okay, I'd give you a pass on that one, because even though it's some of his best work, The Thing is really the pinnacle,
Yeah.
the one that everybody goes to. But yeah, there's just it's amazing that there's so many films that people haven't. Like I would even say in my top 10, I wouldn't even have probably Mike Myers or like a Halloween movie or a Friday 13th movie. I'd have Nightmare on Elm Street before I'd have those two on my list.
Yeah.
Just because I feel from a point of character, storyline, and horror movie, it sort of embodies all of that really well. It's like Scream, one of the classic great horror movies.
Yeah.
And look, you got that poster on the back of your wall too. So we're right in line with it. It's like these are fundamentals that you have to see. And although I know Halloween and Chucky and those sort of land in the sort of pop art, society norms as horror movies. I think there are a lot better ones without putting my foot in my mouth to your fans that really embody like the horror movie genre even better, right? Evil Dead 2, by
Yeah.
far one of the greatest horror movies. Don't watch the first one. You don't have to see Army of Darkness, but you got to see Evil Dead 2,
Oh yeah. No, I agree 100%. And that's why it's one of those things with like that's why I said Nightmare on Elm Street is my number two horror film is because with Freddy he's got the charisma that Michael Myers and Jason are just silent. You know what I mean? It's and they got some cool kills, but Michael Myers to me is kind of boring. That's why I prefer Halloween 3. Obviously, I got plenty of Halloween 3 stuff behind me, but
Yeah.
with Freddy, it's like not only has he got the charisma, but his kills are crazy. Like he's pulling people's tendons out and walking them like they're, a marionette and stuff like that. Where again, Jason's got some creative kills where the guy's doing a handstand and gets, chopped with the axe while
Sure.
he's doing a handstand. And but it's just like a lot of that's just stabbing too. So no, I'm with you. And then Chucky almost, I didn't really start to enjoy Chucky films until Bride of Chucky. And at that point, they become comedies more than horror films. They're like comedy sprinkled with horror instead of the other way around. So
Yeah.
no, I'm with you. There's so much better ways to look at. And I don't dislike Chucky. Obviously, I have the little Chucky doll, which I bought for my son because he likes Chucky. But it's one of those things that it's like I enjoy those films. I'm just they're not, and I enjoy the original Halloween and respect it for what it is. It's just
Yeah.
not my favorite. And people are like, oh, it's the pinnacle slasher. I'm like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out before. I prefer that. I
Oh.
pre Black Christmas came out before. I prefer Black Christmas to both of those. So I feel like Black Christmas is the way a horror movie should end, and the way that Halloween should have ended with the mystery and just leave it the way it was. So they
The
didn't
way it
ruin,
is.
yeah, they didn't ruin that. I mean, they ruined it with a couple bad remakes, but that's not the same thing as like sequels where they're like all of a sudden we know Billy is this person's brother and he's living there because his mother used to live there as a sorority sister back in 1940. Like the where we learned that, like by Halloween 2, where they've already ruined the mystery of Michael Myers by being like, oh, he's Laurie's sister, so he's coming after her and stuff like that. So
right. Oh, you know, that speaks. There is a horror movie that I don't think a lot of people have seen. It's become one of my favorite horror movies in the last several years. It's called The Christmas Horror Story.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that. I started watching it when Joe Bob was showing it, but it was back when he was still doing super late nights and I fell asleep because, like, I'm on the East Coast, so it's late over here.
Okay.
The second movie rolls
around. Is that the one with William Shatner and the is being the radio host?
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that movie. I watch it every year with my kids. It's one of our Christmas movies.
Oh yeah, no, definitely check it out for sure. I love watching. Like the past few years, I'd stopped watching like the main go to horror Christmas movies. I think my of course I still watch Black Christmas and Gremlins and stuff, but like I always try to fit in like Christmas Evil and Deadly Games. You know, that French one. And, Rare Exports is another fun one. If you haven't checked out either of those, I definitely recommend checking those out.
I haven't checked out Rare Exports. I'll check that one out.
Rare Exports is pretty much
Trick or Treat.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Great one. Yeah.
I got Sam over there as well. He's just kind of
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Trick or Treat. That was and I like the Sammy Kerr Trick or Treat. I don't know if that's the one you're talking about, but with the rock and roll Trick or Treat from the '80s. I don't know if you ever seen that one.
No.
Yeah,
yes. I know which one you're talking about. The rock and roll, yeah, from the 80s. Big glam hair, yes. Yeah.
But and a great list of horror films. Like I said, like you said, we're kind of on the same page of like what's, you know, the top notch ones for sure. But and then my final question I like to ask all my guests, you know, from, you know, the musicians to the, you know, the people in the makeup effects artists, I mean, pretty much just in the horror business in general, in the movie business, I like to ask all my guests, what's a horror story of your own? And, you know, it could be from a bad day on set to just something that was scary as shit in your personal life. And if you believe in the paranormal, you're more than welcome to share that kind of story as well.
Wow. It's another one of those questions that, you know, when in retrospect, when you ask that, I immediately think how boring my life is because I'm not a paranormal person, so I don't really have those experiences. I don't maybe even leave myself open mentally to having those kinds of experiences. I, you know, knock on wood, I've lived a healthy life so far. So I tend to keep my head on my shoulders. I'm trying to think, I mean, you know, a horror experience for me probably does have to do with being on set and doing something poorly. I've gotten to this comfortable place in my life with enough years of experience that although I understand shit can happen and things don't always go perfect and I can, you know, I now don't put that much pressure on myself to feel like I have to be perfect. Right. But then again, there's the other side of it, which is I position myself, in my community where people pay me pretty well to do my job well. And so the last thing you want to do is not your job well and have a disaster on your hands. And I've had a couple of those. I would say my and it's not going to be exciting for anybody there on your with your listeners. I was on a set one time doing a makeup. This was for a show called Truth Be Told on Apple. It was just recently. It was a few years ago. And I was doing a bald cap. And I had already done it on this actress for this show a couple times. I had mixed up my paint, my thinner for my paints with adhesive remover. And it was a complete, don't know why it happened, but I ended up figuring it out. So as I'm painting this bald cap piece that I had to make, and we were doing these close-up shots on her that day, and it was this very intimate emotional moment. She had cancer and she was bald, and I had painted her, and before we even left the trailer, it all just started peeling up around the edges and sliding, and I was like, what's happening? It just freaked me out. And so I kind of cleaned it up and re-glued it before we left and added some more paint to make sure that it was all tied in and looking beautiful. And 10 minutes later, everything just started slipping and sliding. And for me, that was one of those horrifying moments of having to walk onto the set with a makeup that did not look good, go to the producers and say, yeah, you're going to have to fix all of this in post. Yeah. I can do what I can to sort of manage it, but it doesn't look good. And of course, answer those questions, fall on the sword of, I don't know what happened. It just didn't work out. And that's just one example. I mean, look, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
But man, it's a fucking horrifying, gut-wrenching, heart-sinking moment to be like, wow, you just paid me a lot of money to screw up.
Yeah. One kind of small question to piggyback that, you know, still, you know, this would be my last one. Would you say, you know, like you said, you've been in the business since like the late 90s and stuff, which I'm not mistaken, one of your first films was Chill Factor, which you worked up with my buddy Jeff Goodwin, who's been on the show. I went and had lunch with him and stuff like that. He's a real nice guy Chill as well. Factor. But
jeez. Yeah.
Which, of course, I brought that up to him because of Skeet Ulrich rules. But no, but would you say it's kind of gotten easier over time or harder with, you know, the, you know, a lot of people going from film to strictly digital, you know, filming, you know, because with film, obviously you have less takes. But then when digital comes around, some of these directors all of a sudden, you know, become Stanley Kubrick and think that they have 100 takes because they have digital. So would you say that it becomes harder for you? Or maybe slightly easier because you know that there's not that like, oh shit, this is all the film we have.
That's a good question. And it's I'm going to answer it a little bit differently than what you're asking, because I think the answer is somewhere actually in a different place.
Yeah.
Meaning that film was beautiful for the fact that it would give you a moment to pause. They could only shoot for so long. They would have to stop the camera, and it would allow you to come in and correct or fix or readjust a makeup. Digital, they just, like you said, they'll just keep filming. It's not even however many takes. It's more of they'll just keep the camera on,
yeah,
and not let anybody in. And you're sitting there going, well, hey guys, this whole thing was planned to have this blood drip start here and end here. You've continued to film, and now it's just dripping off his chin. That's not what this moment's about.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly sort of having to interfere and ask those questions. What's changed more than anything, though, is the fact that they don't want to give time to practical effects.
Yeah.
And so what we've seen is less about the concern that they can just keep filming with digital or that film is expensive, but they stop it every now and then. What it's come down to now more than often is we get one opportunity. If we're doing like a gag effect, we get one opportunity to do it. So what they'll commonly do is they'll film it without any gag. Then they'll film it a second time with the gag, but no liquid. Let's say you're cutting a throat and blood's supposed to gush out.
Yeah.
They'll film just with the basic actions. Then they'll film it again with the knife coming across, her reacting, you know, this and the, you know, supposed to be blood coming out, no blood. And they'll do that until they have the take that they want.
Yeah.
Then what they'll do is they'll say, okay, you get one take for the blood.
Mm.
That's it. And if it works well, that's the take we use. If it doesn't work well, we're going to go back to one of those other takes and we're going to digitally do it.
Yeah. Whether they have to digitally do the throat cut again or just the blood. It's yeah.
Yeah. And it has everything to do with money. And look, you can't blame them for it. You have 80 people around a set. It's costing them $150,000 an hour, you know, to sit there. And if you do a blood gag and all of a sudden it's like, okay, we got to change the jacket, change the shirt, clean up the neck, refill the pumps, this is going to take 20 minutes to reset. They're looking at that going, well, that's going to cost me $40,000 to reset. I can pay a digital guy $10,000 to make it amazing in post-production and do exactly what I want when I want it, time it perfect, blah, blah, blah. And you and I both know it's not the same, but they're getting a lot better at it. And so now what we've found is on these big productions is we kind of get one shot at doing our job right.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's going to visual effects. And so, you know, it makes it a lot more important to test these effects in advance, make sure that they work in advance. And the problem with that is they don't give you a lot of time nowadays. You know, you don't get those days of Steve Johnson and Rick Baker and, you know, Greg Canham and all these people who had, you know, 6 months to build effects for a show. You get 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't even get the actor who's a part of the effect. And so you're building blind, and it just makes it really, really hard.
Yeah. I definitely know what you mean, for sure. It's that's why, like, you know, to kind of circle back to the very beginning, that's why I said I knew it was, you know, anybody that got that call to be on Terrifier knew it would at least be fun, whether they liked the films or not, because they finally get to do something where everything's in front of the camera. So, you know,
yeah,
it's pretty awesome for sure. But hell yeah. But and then, of course, like, yeah, it's one of my favorite films is and favorite horror comedies is Freaked, which, you know, the Alex Winter filmed and stuff. And that's one of the, like, it's, you don't hear about that these days. Like, that film had Screaming Mad George, Bill Corso, Norman Cabrera, like all these people getting called in to work together. You know, nowadays, yep, it's literally like you have this team, they're working on the film. You have this team, they'll work on the film. You know, it's hard to, you don't see a lot of team crossover anymore either. You know, it's where back in the day they'd have, like, you know, like the new Dune movies would have had four practical effects teams on them if it was still David Lynch doing it. So
yeah,
stuff like that. But no, yeah, I appreciate your time, man. I had a blast chatting with you, and had a lot of really fun information. Thank you for, you know, being willing to talk about Terrifier 3. I was worried about asking, and then you'd be like, no.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, and look, you know, when Damien starts talking about it more, and Damien wants to let out a little bit more teaser information about it or something like that, happy to come back, happy to talk about it, happy to walk through, you know, how we built stuff, what we built for it. But as of right now, I got to respect Damien's, you know, Damien's property here. He's worked really hard to get this amazing IP off the ground, and people love it. And it's great to have that kind of energy behind a film where, you know, there's such a hardcore fan base waiting, you know, for something like this. Whereas, you know, most films come and go and you don't even know they were there. And it's just, it's really exciting to be a part of something that's cool. That's got all this momentum.
Hell yeah. No, I'll definitely be seeing it in the theaters. So maybe once it comes out, I'll, you know, we can link up and do like a spoiler episode and just, you know, like put that in the beginning and let people know we're going to talk about those gags and stuff. But I know we'll be kind of going, it comes out October 25th. So we'll be heading into like holiday, you know, like Thanksgiving and Christmas. So I'll hit you up and see if we can work it out. And if not, you know, maybe after the new year, we'll, by that time, more people should have seen it anyway. So it'll be their fault at that point.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't protect the spoiler too long.
Right. Especially with, I'm sure they have some kind of deal with Screenbox or something where, you know, in January, February, it'll probably, I'm sure it won't be too soon, you know, but just like the last film, after like 3 or 4 months, it already was like announced to go onto a streaming service.
So. Well, maybe even earlier. It's a Christmas movie, you know, so.
True. Very true.
So, you makes know, sense. you want to get those, you know, October dollars as well as those Christmas dollars.
Very true. They can just probably release it again on Christmas. I'd go out and see it again.
That's right. Yeah, they should.
Put the kid to bed and go watch people get filleted. But no, man, I appreciate you. Enjoy the rest of your day. And like I said, thanks again for coming on the show.
You got it, man. All right. Thank you for having me.
And as usual, I just want to say thanks again for listening, and make sure you check back next week. As I know, originally I announced that I would be joined once again by Ray from End It, but unfortunately he hopped on tour and we haven't been able to link up yet due to scheduling. So instead I'll be joined by the one and only Bill Karakristos of the band Gloomer. So check back next week for that. Go follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and X for all updates on the podcast. If you'd like to come out to Carolina Fear Fest, don't forget you can get your tickets in the description. Also, if you'd like to sign up for the Patreon, it is only $2 a month. The link for that is in the description. Or you can just share the podcast around or rate and subscribe wherever you're listening. All support is appreciated. Thank you guys again so much for listening, and stay safe.